All right, good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday, April 19th, 11:15 a.m., and we're doing Chem 12A. We're going to pick up where we left off from. So what we were doing were the SN1, SN2 reactions. So previously we did SN1 substitution nucleophilic first order and substitution nucleophilic second order. So these were substitution reactions. Today, we're going to pick it up with E1 and E2. E1 and E2 are elimination reactions. So whereas we were doing substitutions before, we're going to be looking at eliminations today and moving forward here for a little bit. So with elimination reactions, let's take a look at a style of elimination reaction. There are many different forms in which we can look at elimination reactions. We can have many different types of leaving groups. So in general, what we have is we have a leaving group that sits there, a proton. We have a reaction here that has a base. Let's say that that base equals B minus. And B minus comes and takes the proton and kicks out the leaving group to generate BH, the conjugate acid. And we didn't end up with the alkene, and we end up with a leaving group coming off that is negatively charged. These are both regio-specific and stereo-specific, or we could say regio-selective and stereo-selective. Let's say stereo-selective. So what that means is that the region in which the double bond is formed, the location that the double bond is formed, that's what regioselective means. Regioselective equals the location of the double bond. And the stereoselective is the stereo nature of the double bond, cis versus trans. In this case, it means cis versus trans. But in another stereo sense, if we talk about stereoselective, it could also mean S versus R. But not for double bonds. For double bonds, we look at cis versus trans. Okay, so what do we mean? Let's pick this up and let's dig into this a little bit deeper. Let's start with some of these reactions that are regioselective, and let's look at them specifically in terms of alcohols and the dehydration reactions. So we're going to take a look at dehydration, which is also a type of elimination reaction. In a dehydration reaction, what we typically have is we typically have a hydroxyl group, and instead of a base, these react by undergoing with acid to produce the double bond, the alkene, and water is a byproduct. They're very similar to the general reaction that I've shown over here. The leaving group just has to be protonated in order for the leaving group to actually go. So in general, most of the time, these are under basic conditions, but with alcohols, we can see them under acidic conditions. These are also regio and stereoselective, and they're a good spot to start looking at some of these elimination reactions. So let's take a look at what it means to be regioselective. So here, what we'll start with is a alcohol. Tertiary alcohol, we'll react it with H2SO4 and we'll turn up the heat a bit, 80 degrees Celsius. As the reaction goes forward, we get two different products out of this. We get an alkene that we find in 10% and an alkene that we find in 90%. So just stopping there for a second, let's backtrack and look at what's happening here. If I number these carbons, let's start here. 1, 2, 3, 4. This would be carbon number 1, 2, 3, and 4, and carbon number 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so what we're seeing is that we're seeing the double bond occurring in two different locations. One of those locations, we're seeing the double bond occurring here in this carbon. And in another sense, we're seeing it occurring between the 2 and 3 bond there. And we're seeing a preference, a desire to have that double bond form between the 2 and 3 as opposed to what would be a 1 and 2 position out here. And the difference between these double bonds is that one of these is disubstituted. And the other one is trisubstituted. So what we mean by disubstituted and trisubstituted is now I'm looking at the number of carbons that are bound to the double bond. There are two carbons that are bound to the double bond, that is disubstituted, versus 3 carbons bound to the double bond, which is trisubstituted. And we're seeing a preference for higher substitution, for more substitution. Let's look at another one. Here we have a cyclic molecule, cyclohexane derivative. This also an alcohol. We're ignoring stereochemistry for the moment. We'll react this one with an acid H3PO4, also heat. And we wind up with two different products coming out of this reaction. One where the double bond is towards the methyl group, and the other one where the double bond is to the opposite side. And we see them in about 84% to 16%. Again, we can go through and we can number all of the carbons. We can track where everything is going. Let's make the hydroxyl group number 1, the methyl group where it's attached, number 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So we're numbering counterclockwise. Numbering system stays the same, nothing changes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So double bond between 1 and 2, and double bond 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 between 1 and 6. So again, we're looking at the double bond occurring, let's choose green here, between 1 and 6. And in the first one, we were between 1 and 2. And again, we can look at the degree of substitution and we can say what degree of substituted are we. If we look at the degree of substitution, we find that this one is a 1, 2, 3. This is a trisubstituted. And the other one is disubstituted. All right, and let's track that last one. This one is 1, 2 groups bound to the double bond. Maybe it's a little bit easier if I go through and just highlight, rather than just tracking the carbons, you can see the substitution and how many things are bound to the double bond. Did that one wrong. There we go. So you can see the degree of substitution on the double bond, lost that last one, and what is being selected for is the higher substitution rate. That the more substituted the double bond is, the higher its rate is. Which takes us to a general rule, Zaitsev's rule. So Zaitsev's rule is a rather simplistic rule It is from 1875, named after Alexander Zaitsev. Let me move that over. And Zaitsev's rule basically says that when a double bond can form, that the more substituted double bond is the preferred double bond. And that's what Zaitsev's rule says. It's really rather simplistic. So when we look at this, Zaitsev's rule, the more substituted double bond will be the major. Let's take a look at that in context of mechanism. And let's do that. We'll get to Zaitsev's rule in more detail and look at how and why that happens. But let's take a look in greater detail because we haven't even started with the mechanism yet. And I don't like to memorize rules as much. You guys know this about me already, that rules to me imply that they don't always work because it's a rule, not a law. And so while rules can be generally very helpful in trying to figure out what a product is, and memorizing a simplistic rule can be very helpful, understanding the underlying mechanism and when the rule works and when the rule doesn't work is more important, or at least in my book is more important. So while I'll talk about Zaitsev's rule, I won't put a whole lot of emphasis on it because I'm going to go from a mechanistic point of view. So let's take a look at the first reaction, E1. So this is elimination first order. An elimination first order reaction, and we'll do it from the alcohol, and let's start with tertiary butanol. The reaction starts through protonation. We can either have an acid where we have the proton there, or we could have that acid attached to the rest of the molecule. We could have it attached to HB, and we could take the proton. In general, what happens is we pick up that proton first. We create a good leaving group. Remember that hydroxyl groups on their own are not good leaving groups. We haven't discussed why just yet, but for it to come off, it's such a strong base that it's not very energetically stable for it to come off all on its own. But once it's protonated, now it is more energetically favorable for it to just come off. And we go to the carbocation. In this case, a tertiary carbocation. A water molecule has come off and been liberated. That water molecule can serve as a base to take a proton, which then dumps the electrons into the bond in order to create the double bond. And the byproduct is hydronium. So reaction mechanism wise, if we take that and we put that into an energy diagram, what we see is that we're starting off with that protonation. Let's go here. We go to the protonated hydroxyl group, the carbocation intermediate, and then the alkene. So energy-wise, we're starting off here. We protonate that hydroxyl group. We come down in energy, presumably, because usually we're dealing with something like sulfuric acid or phosphoric acid, which is a stronger acid than the hydronium that gets created here, the protonated oxonium ion. And so the whole system comes down in energy because because we're protonating that hydroxyl group, and that's lower energy. And then the whole system, when the leaving group comes off and we go to the carbocation, now we're at very high energy. And this is the rate determining step, is the formation of the carbocation. So that is my rate determining step. We'll hit that activation energy. And this is the rate determining step. And then we have that elimination reaction where we take the proton, kicking the electrons back in to generate the double bond, and we get the alkene, and we get the hydronium. And notice that this reaction is overall endothermic, that the products here are higher in energy than our starting material. But anytime we're going to a double bond, generally going to a higher energy material. And so this is endothermic overall. And that first step there is our rate determining step, is the carbocation formation. And so when I look at the rate of an E1, the rate of an E1 reaction is equal to some rate constant times the concentration, and we'll just leave it as our leaving group. Let's not put it as the hydroxyl. Let's just leave it as our leaving group. And that this is unimolecular, and it is essentially the same rate law. I'll remind you that the rate on an SN1 reaction that was undergoing the same carbocation formation was equal to K times the concentration of our leaving group. They have exactly the same rate law, which means that they proceed at the same rate and compete with each other. So this is a reminder about the rate of the SN1 reaction. So it's exactly the same as an SN1, and the same factors apply as for SN1. In other words, when we look at the rate based on substrate is that the tertiary is far faster than a secondary, which is faster than a primary. And again, that's back to Hammond postulate, because when we look at this rate and we're going to the carbocation, anything that makes the carbocation more stable will also draw down the activation energy for that transition state, and that'll make the reaction run faster. Anything that increases the energy of that carbocation, such as going to a secondary or primary, will conversely increase the energy of the transition state, increasing the activation energy, and make the reaction run slower. So we see those same things going on in this reaction as we did within the SN1 reactions. Okay, but what about that Zaitsev's rule? And what about when I can get different types of double bonds forming? So here in this one, in this tertiary butanol that we had, there was only a single type of carbon within the carbocation. We had the tertiary carbocation, and then each one of the carbons were equivalent, allowing me to only get one type of double bond. What happens if that's not the case? What happens if I could get multiple types of double bonds? That's where we get into Zaitsev's rule. So let's take a look at that mechanism from the prospect of a material that may have different different locations where the double bond can form. So here what we'll do is we'll take the proton, pick it up, create the good leaving group. The leaving group can now leave. We create the carbocation, And then when I draw the carbocation, I like to give good bond angles to my carbocations. And so rather than leaving it as drawn previously, see, I would have drawn it maybe this way, but it still looks tetrahedral that way. And so what I do is I prefer to spread it out looking trigonal planar as opposed to tetrahedral. And so I change my bond angles a little bit when I draw that carbocation. And now there are two different types of carbons. I can look at the hydrogens that are attached out here. These hydrogens, we can call them all HA. There are an equivalent set of HA that are down on this carbon. Those are all the same proton. So I'm going to say that going out these two directions, that these guys are all identical in terms of their position relative to that carbocation. And then I have two protons that are alpha to the carbocation, and these are HB. So this is a different set and needs to be considered separately. If I were to pull HB, what I would do is I would take and use the water molecule. Let's pull an HA first. I would take and use a water molecule or the conjugate base of the acid to pull the proton and to push the electrons into there. This would be a loss of HA, taking HA away. What happens here is I create a double bond that is the less substituted double bond. And if that water molecule were to come over on this side and to pull one of the HBs, and I dump the electrons in this way, let's change that arrow. Just make that arrow a little bit larger so it's a little bit easier to see where it's going. And now this is a loss of HB. We can track which direction we're going. This now leads to a double bond, which forms this way, and this is more substituted. So what's happening here, and why am I selecting for the more substituted versus the less substituted? Well, we need to take a look at the reaction conditions, and we need to sort out an energy diagram and understand by an energy diagram why these are happening the way they're happening. So let's take the energy diagram and start putting this into it and see if we can't make some sense out of it. Now, there's a couple of different ways that I could draw this energy diagram. I think what I'm going to do is just a more traditional one rather than trying to do something a little bit tricky to make it easier to see. First, let's do just a traditional one and show what's happening here. So the first thing is we start off here. With our protonation step. Once we protonate that, we're going to go to a lower energy system. And then we're going to have that leaving group leave. We'll go through our rate determining step and we will go to the carbocation. And then this is where things start to get interesting in terms of what happens with the carbocation and what proton winds up getting pulled. So let me first make these guys. Interestingly enough, sometimes it wants to work and sometimes it doesn't. You would think it would just work all the time. Okay, so now what happens is when I take a look at these two products, one of these products is more thermodynamically stable than the other. Remember what we said about the substitution of a double bond. The more substituted a double bond is, the more stable a double bond is. And so when we find that we have different substitution patterns, for instance, this one is trisubstituted versus this one, which is geminal disubstituted, the more substituted a product is, the more stable it is. And so what we would find is that that first product, while being an endothermic reaction overall, this product is the more stable product. The other product, being less stable, let's put it here. And I'll spread them out a little bit. And one's just a little bit in higher energy than the other. And I want them both to be higher in energy than my starting material because I'm an endothermic reaction overall. So they are both a little bit over that. Now we need to ask, well, what happens about pulling these two protons? What is it that's going on here in terms of pulling the two protons? And what are these different, what are the differences between these protons? Well, we can classify these protons that are in blue by their position. In other words, these are on a methyl group. A methyl group that has three different protons on it. That type of position, if I look at the position and I take and look at all the positions out here, this is a primary position, a secondary position. We're primary out here. And we would rank that in the center here that this is a tertiary position, but this is actually the position of the carbocation. And we're only looking at one bond away from the carbocation, so that primary one doesn't really count. So I'm looking at the differences between primary and secondary. Now, what do I know about these positions and the sterics around these positions relative to a nucleophile or a base trying to come in and to take the proton? Access from the base in order to get to a primary position is fairly open. But if a base tries to attack a secondary position, it feels more sterics around the secondary position. Perhaps what we want to do is do the sterics in red, indicating that the secondary position has more sterics around it. It's a little bit harder to access, whereas a primary position has less sterics around it, easier to access. What does that mean in terms of my transition states? What that means is that when I'm trying to get to the secondary center, which is going to be this center over here, going to this more substituted, that's a higher energy location to try to get to. That's going to put my transition state at a higher energy transition state. Let's put it here. And the other one on the primary center, which is going to the less substituted, that one is going to be at a lower energy transition state. Let's put it here. And so what we see energetically is that when I go to form these, come on, you can do this. There it goes. When I go to form these, I have a very small activation energy for one and a relatively large activation energy for the other. I think I'll leave it out here where it's a little bit easier to see. And I don't need those lines anymore. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull this down so that we can make a little bit more sense out of it. So what we see here is we see high sterics. Equals high energy. High E sub A. That E sub A is the E sub A that is there. And for this one is lower sterics. And that equals low E sub A. And that E sub A is right there. And you say, well, wait a minute, hold on. I'm remembering what you told me before, and you told me that this is the rate determining step. And that this is the E sub A for the rate determining step. and the rate determining step is the only thing that really influences my product ratios. Yes and no. The rate determining step determines how the reaction proceeds and how fast the reaction proceeds to the intermediate, possibly to the product, depending upon what that reaction actually looks like. In this case, we're going to the carbocation. But once the carbocation forms, then I get into a situation where I can have a less stable product and a more stable product. But the more stable product has a higher activation energy, and the less stable product has a lower activation energy. This is where we get into that kinetic versus thermodynamic situation. And so what we see here is that this product with the low activation energy, this is the kinetic product. The kinetic product is favored by short reaction times and low temps. The other one is called the thermodynamic product. And the thermodynamic product is favored by high reaction temps and longer reaction times. So how does this play into Zaitsev's rule? Well, when we go back to these reactions and we're looking at these reactions, many of these reactions that I was showing you before had high heat, 80 degrees C, refluxing temperatures. That high heat is going to give us enough energy to be able to make it over this high activation energy barrier. And then this part of the reaction here is reversible. So what we see is when we form the carbocation, the first thing that likely forms is that kinetic product. But the kinetic product can go back and forth, can pick up the proton back from the hydronium and can go back to the carbocation. And as it's bouncing back and forth, if there's enough energy and the temperature is high enough, then every once in a while, one of those molecules will jump over and go to the thermodynamic product. Now going backwards, this reaction is also reversible, but it has a much higher E sub A for its reversible reaction. So it starts to act like a thermodynamic sink. It starts to act as a trap where every molecule that comes over here gets trapped in this position. And so as these guys are bouncing back and forth, each one that lands over here starts to accumulate, and this starts to become the major product over time and with enough energy. And so Zaitsev's rule comes from the idea that when we run these SN or these E1 reactions, that generally we're running them under thermodynamic conditions, high temperature, longer reaction times, pushing it towards its end product. And that in those cases, Zaitsev's rule holds, and we find that the more substituted product is the major product. But there are conditions and there are sets of conditions that we can go through and we can select for the kinetic product, or at least we can try to get more of the kinetic product. And it just has to do with changing our reaction conditions. So let's show an example of that. This is why I don't favor the rules as much as I favor understanding a chemical reaction, because it's not true to say that Zaitsev's rule always holds and that I always get the more substituted. That's not the case. Let's take this same substrate we've been using. And for this substrate, what we will do is the same reaction. We'll use H2SO4. And we'll only do the reaction for 1 hour. So we do it for a shorter duration. And in addition to that, we're going to vary the temperature so that we'll run the reaction at 80 degrees and see what the product ratio is. And we'll run the reaction at 30 degrees and see what the products are. So remember that we had the two possible products that came out of this reaction. Those two possible products, this one was the kinetic, and this one's the thermodynamic. And the product ratios, when I run this at 80 degrees C, a higher temp, the higher temperature favors the thermodynamic product. I get 90% of that thermodynamic and only 10% of the kinetic. But if I run this at a lower temperature where there's not quite enough energy to make it over that higher activation energy barrier, then I can actually flip this and get 60% and 40%. Now I can't flip it 90-10 in the other direction, but what I can do is I can flip it enough in order to get 60% of that kinetic product. And so the high temp, again here, high temp, equals thermocontrol, and low temp equals kinetic. So that's what's going on there. All right, let's take a look at a couple of other reactions then. So let's take and look at this guy. And we'll stick with alcohols for a little bit. And we'll run this with H3PO4 and heat. So you should be able to predict this at this point. In predicting this, as we go through and we look at the two possible double bonds, the double bond could form on this side or on this side. And so as we go through and we push that through the carbocation and we look at the two different possible products that can form, I should be able to look at this and say, all right, I should be able to get that product. I should be able to get this product, although I did that incorrectly. Let's fix that, because notice what I did. This is 1, 2, 3. So there are 1, 2, 3, that would be 4, and the double bond constitutes 5. That's 5 bonds to carbon. So we can't have 5 bonds to carbon. So that looks like it's the only product that I could get, except it's not. There are actually other products that I can get out of this. It's just not the one that I was about to draw. So what happens is when we go through this carbocation, let's pick up the proton first. We'll do a quick little mechanism. We'll pick up that proton. We'll let the leaving group leave. We'll go to the carbocation. So there's no proton to be able to pull over here. There are only the protons that I can pull on this side. And pulling one of those guys is what leads to this product. So how do I get any other products coming out of this? That seems like the only thing that I can get. Except remember that when we have carbocations, one of the things that can happen is the rearrangement. We can get a 1-2 alkyl shift. And we need to start watching for these very closely. So once we get the 1-2 alkyl shift, now I get a more stable carbocation. So let's just check here. Let's say that this was number 1, 2, 3, 4, and I had the 2 methyls on number 3. This would still be number 1, 2, 3, and 4. And now what I had is one of the methyl groups move onto carbon number 2. So there's my methyl group that has moved onto carbon number 2. One of the methyl groups is remaining on carbon number 3. And this was a secondary carbocation, and it moved to a tertiary carbocation, which is why it migrated. And now that it's at a tertiary carbocation, now there are different protons that I could pull. There is a proton that is right here. And there are a series of protons that are adjacent that are out here. So I could pull either the primary proton that is the blue one, or I could pull that one single tertiary proton that is on carbon number 2, and those would each lead to different products. So I could get a product that is going to look like that. Nope, I missed it. One more methyl. There we go. Let's number it just to make sure. This was number 1, 2, 3, and 4. So what I presumably did was pull the proton here, pushing the electrons into number 3. That's where that one came from. And my second product is going to be the double bond between 2 and 3. So this would be 1, 2, 3, and 4. And as we take a look at those different products, what we see is a clear difference in substitution patterns. So we have a monosubstituted, a disubstituted, and tetrasubstituted. And going back to the heat and looking at the amount of energy that's in the system, this is high heat. This is going to select for the thermodynamic product. And that thermodynamic product is this guy, is the tetrasubstituted. So product ratios in this, what I see is 64%. I'm going to pull this out of the way just a little bit. 64% for that tetrasubstituted. The disubstituted comes in at 33%. And that monosubstituted, only at 3%. All right, so we can see where that reaction goes to. Let's look at a couple more. Maybe not quite in such detail. We'll go a little bit faster. This is a primary alcohol undergoing very similar reaction with phosphoric acid, H3PO4, and heat. We get the primary double bond, the terminal double bond. We can get the internal double bond, and there are two different configurations for that internal double bond. We could get the trans or the cis. And what we see ratio-wise is that the trans is about 56%, the cis 32%, and 12% for that monosubstituted. So again, here we're at monosubstituted, and both of these are disubstituted. And those disubstituted together equal about 88%. So we can see that clear favorite for the thermodynamic product, the more substituted product. We're seeing Zajac's rule in play there. All right. Where do we want to go here? Let's look at dehydrohalogenations. So let's make a switch from these and let's go take a look at dehydrohalogenation. Maybe there's a question of why am I seeing more trans than cis? That's an interesting question to look at too. Why would I see more trans product than cis product? And that has to do with the pulling of the proton. Maybe we should ask that question because I don't address that question yet. That's actually a question that I tend to explain when I get into the dehydrohalogenations. And it has to do with that carbocation and which proton gets pulled. And if we take a look at this material, we didn't even ask, how is it from that primary carbocation? How did I get the double bond over here? So first off, maybe we should go to that primary carbocation and say that, but that primary carbocation means super unstable. We get the 1,2 hydride shift. So now the carbocation is sitting here and I have that proton over there. That was the 1,2 hydride. But now that I'm looking at a 1,2 hydride, now there are protons which are over here, which I'm pulling to get cis and trans. And so how do I know which one of those leads to cis and how do I know which one leads to trans? Because they look like the same proton. So what's actually happening there? That's a great question in and of itself. Let's call one of these protons HA, and let's call one of these protons HB, And let's make it so we can distinguish between the protons. Distinguishing between the protons means that one of these protons is coming forward and one of these protons is going back. And now we can look at pulling HA versus pulling HB. How do I know what pulling HA actually looks like? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at it this way, through a Newman projection. So if we draw this as a Newman projection and we take a look at what is actually happening there, what we have is we have the methyl group. We have HA on the right-hand side. We have HB on the left-hand side. And in the back, we've got a really good question of what's going on in the back. What's going on in the back is that the back is got a proton on it and a CH3 group, and that's the carbocation that's in the back. So if the carbocation is in the back and it's flat, that back carbon is trigonal planar. And now I have to look at what happens if I pull HB versus pulling HA. And in order to pull them, what I have to do is I have to have the orbitals aligned in the proper way in order to pull it. So if we think about the carbocation and what's going on with the carbocation, I'll continue to draw it up here. If we think about the carbocation this way, here's my carbon. Going back in the plane is the methyl group. Coming forward in the plane is the hydrogen that's on that carbocation. And this is the empty p orbital. In order to pull the proton to create the double bond, what I need to do is I need to pull a proton so that this electrons from the sigma bond can dump into that orbital, which means that the proton that I'm pulling has to be in line with the carbocation. That carbocation right now is sitting in the back, is sitting there. So I have to rotate this HB to come up or HA to come up before I can pull the proton in order to dump the energy into that carbocation. So I'm going to erase this guy, the orbital, because that just kind of clouds things. And I'm going to go through and I'm going to look at pulling the two different protons. So I'm going to rotate it into the two different configurations in order to examine pulling the proton. So let's put HA there, and then that's going to move the methyl group onto that side. And that'll move HB down, the CH3 group, and the proton. And on the other one, I'm going to put HB up. And that's going to move HA to the right-hand side and the methyl group and the proton. So now what happens is when the base comes in, whatever it is that I'm using as a base in order to pull this proton, be it a water molecule or whatever else, as that proton gets pulled and the electrons dump into that orbital, these guys are going to lift and to become sp2 hybridized at that front carbon. This one is going to put the methyl group and the HB close together on the same side of the double bond. So what I will create is a bond here where I have the methyl group and the hydrogen and the methyl group and HB. Notice that the methyls are on opposite sides. This is the trans product. Where I have HB, I flipped it and rotated it in not the way that I wanted to do. No, this will work. HB can go there and H there. And then the other one, when I pull the proton, and now I'm pulling HB and I'm dumping the electrons into there. That one is going to look like this. HA is on the right, the methyl group is on the left, and then the back methyl group is on the same side as the front methyl group. And so that one is the cis product. That one is where the two methyls, and I need to be careful the way that I draw this. Come on, erase. Let me turn it this way. And since I'm doing that, this will be HA. And this will be the H from the other one. And they're on the same side. So this is the trans. And this is the cis. Okay. Notice that in these transition states, what's going on here in terms of the amount of energy that's going on, the two methyl groups are gauged to each other, or they're on the same side. They're interacting in a way that increases the energy in this system. This is very high energy. This is a high energy conformation to get HB in this conformation. The two methyls are eclipsed. That's going to be high E sub A. And on the other side, the methyls are each eclipsed with hydrogens. And this is a lower energy conformation. No methyls eclipsed. And so what that does is that winds up favoring the trans products in terms of how we look at them. So that's where that comes from. Why do we get more of the trans than we do with the cis? It actually goes to the transition state of pulling the proton and the conformations that we find those two things in. All right, so maybe a longer explanation there than what I had anticipated going into. Let's continue on. And as I said, I wanted to look at dehydrohalogenations. So dehydrohalogenation is a type of elimination reaction. In this case, we're not using hydroxyl groups. In this case, we're using halogens. So I'll go through a series of these. We'll show a bunch of them, and then we'll start to investigate sort of what's going on here. In these reactions, we do use a base, sodium methoxide. And we do the reaction in ethanol at 55 degrees C. Here, what we see is that we get a single product, 100%, the alkene. Byproducts in this would be ethanol, and we would also end up with sodium chloride. These are fairly diverse looking reactions. We can have a primary alkyl halide. We can do the reaction with a different type of base, potassium tert butoxide. And this is in a solvent called dimethyl sulfoxide, DMSO, 25 degrees Celsius. And this gives a product that is, let's get the number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and the terminal double bond. And we get about 86% yield. Potassium tert butoxide, first time that we're seeing that, that's the cation. And this is the anion. So this is a base that is derived from tertiary butanol, and it is the tertiary butoxide anion. And so this part here, we use TBU for tertiary butyl. And then the O follows that, and the K, so KO tertiary butyl is what that is. DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, that's DMSO. common solvent that is used, not very fun to use in that it has a very high boiling point, but useful in that it has a very high boiling point. All right, let's look at a couple more. Let's do chlorine in this position. We'll react this with potassium ethoxide as the base. We'll do it in ethanol, but we'll do it at a higher temperature, 70 degrees C. This one leads to two different products. We get the less substituted double bond, and we get the more substituted double bond. Product ratios about 29% and 71%. So the higher temperature leading towards the higher substituted product. And finally, let's do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So let's go 7, and let's put the bromide pretty much smack in the middle. We'll hit this one with potassium ethoxide and ethanol. No temperature given this time. This time what we're looking for is we're looking for the product ratios in terms of, let's see, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 2, 3, double bond, 4, 5, 6, 7. Unless I got one too many bond there. Let me count, make sure that we didn't get that off. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I thought I did one too many. There it is. And the ratios here, this is an E double bond, 77%. And a Z double bond, which is the 23%. So selective again, just like we saw in that last problem that we were doing when we were working out, that generally selective for the trans products, the E products, because they have a lower activation energy for their formation in the way that those are actually forming. These reactions that we've been looking at here, when we look at these, are running in a slightly different way. These dehydrohalogenations, most of the time, particularly when I'm using a strong base like sodium ethoxide or potassium tert butoxide or potassium ethoxide, these reactions are running under what's called an E2 reaction. Let's see, which one I got on the bottom of the page here. So these are E2 reactions. E2 stands for elimination second order. In an E2 reaction, what happens is we have a substrate that has a proton and a leaving group. That substrate may have different things attached to it. So we'll leave that as a stereocenter in that way. The base pulls the proton, and the electrons kick in into the antibonding orbital of the leaving group, which pushes out the leaving group. It goes through a transition state where the double bond is forming, the proton is breaking, and the leaving group is leaving at the same time. The reaction is transitioning from sp3 hybridized to sp2 hybridized, and the base is forming its bond here, so that what I get is I get partial minus on the leaving group, I get partial minus on the base, and bond breaking and bond making are happening simultaneously. The reaction transition state collapses and we get the double bond. We get the leaving group, which is now kicked out with a negative charge. and we get the base, which has now pulled the proton and become its conjugate acid. So the requirement here is really a requirement about the orientation of the proton and the leaving group. Remember what I said is that the proton, when we're pulling this proton, we have to do so such that the electrons here can kick into the antibonding orbital of that leaving group. And if we look at what that antibonding orbital looks like, that antibonding orbital, when I take a look at the leaving group here, this is a sigma bond. And that sigma bond has a small orbital here and here like this. That's the sigma bond itself. But the antibonding orbital is a little bit different. So this is the sigma bond. And that sigma bond has an occupied orbital that is colored like this. Now we're going to look at the antibonding orbital. The antibonding orbital has electron density that is flooding these two areas. And this is what I want to do, is I want to take this sigma bond, which has energy in the sigma bond, electron density in the sigma bond, and I want to dump that electron density into this antibonding orbital. So this electron density wants to dump into there. This is the sigma star antibonding. And this is the sigma of the proton. And so as that base comes in and pulls that proton, the electron density has to dump into the antibonding orbital. If it doesn't dump into that antibonding orbital, then the reaction can't take place. That sets up a requirement that the proton and the leaving group have to be on opposite sides of the molecule, and they have to be aligned. They have to be what's called anti-periplanar. So the leaving group, if I look at this in a Newman projection, and the proton have to be in these two orientations. They must be 180 degrees to each other. It's oftentimes called anti or anti-periplanar. And that's the only orientation in which the proton can be pulled. The proton cannot be pulled in any other orientation. So once that goes through, then we can talk about the energy diagram and the rate and the rest of this reaction. So let's look at the energy diagram first. We're starting off down here where I have the leaving group and the proton antiperiplanar, and the base is going to be pulling that proton, kicking in the electron density and kicking out the leaving group. So let's call that my starting spot. In this reaction, it goes through the transition state, and I'm going to put in the rest of the tetrahedral center here. No, doesn't want to do it this time. Sometimes I think it just doesn't want to do it despite me. And then this is going to go to the product where I have the base attached to the proton, the double bond, and the leaving group, which is now left. I want to make sure that that leaving group doesn't look like it's attached to that alkene. And then this transition state that's here, this transition state is the one that we drew above, where I have the base partially attached to the proton, partially attached to the developing alkene, partially attached to the leading group, and that this is all simultaneous. And so if we want to understand this reaction and how this reaction works, then we need to understand that transition state. And we need to understand what that transition state is like. So we take a look at it and we say, is the transition state more like the reactants or more like the products? And by Hammond postulate, it's closer in energy to the products. The transition state is more product-like. And that's going to give us all of our insight into how this reaction is actually taking place, is that we're going to understand the nature of the alkene, which is going to help us to understand the nature of this transition state and what can raise or lower the energy of that transition state. So we'll come back to that in a second. So I'm going to remind you that we're going to come back and we're going to look at Hammond. In order to get insight into what this chemical reaction is going to look like, the rate of the reaction is going to be equal to an equilibrium or a rate constant times the concentration of our leaving group times the concentration of whatever it is that's pulling the proton. We'll call it a base. So it's a bimolecular rate constant, thus the E2 reaction. And let's remember too that this is the rate of an E1. Excuse me, E2. But I want to remind you, reminder, SN2 rate, which was equal to some rate constant times our leaving group times the concentration of a nucleophile. It's almost the same rate law. It's just the difference between a base versus a nucleophile and understanding what the difference between a base and the nucleophile is. So the rates for these, when I look at these rates, the rate is by substrate, that tertiary is a lot faster than secondary, is a lot faster than primary. And why is that? That happens to be because when we look at this, that the transition state and the activation energy, the transition state is product-like. And because the transition state is product-like, what that means is that the activation energy for the reaction is governed by the structure of the product. Or that we're going to look at the structure of the product in terms of Hammond postulate to start to understand kind of what's going on there. Let's take a look at, let's see, where do I want to go with this? Let's take a look at a reaction. I'm being mindful of time, but I'm getting close. I've got a couple more minutes here to finish some things out. Let's take a look at a reaction where I have an iodide and I'm going to react it under two different reaction conditions. So I'm going to take the same material and I'm going to react it with sodium methoxide in methanol. And I'm going to then look at the reaction with potassium terbutoxide in, actually let's change the solvent. Let's make the solvent the same in both of these so that it's not a solvent issue. This way, there's no question as to what the difference is because they're both in the same solvent. They're both in DMSO. And I'm going to get the same two products out of this chemical reaction. I'm going to get the less substituted and the more substituted double bond. And there's also a cis-trans ratio that's here. So let's say that, let's push this one off. Let's say that I'm going to get these two. And we'll look at those two together. So in the sodium methoxide, I get about 83% combined product ratio. And I get a 3-to-1 trans to cis ratio. So this one is the trans. This one is the cis. And I get 3 times the trans as compared to the cis. Or I should say 3 times more trans than I get for cis in that ratio. And I get about 17% of that primary double bond over there. When I do this with potassium tert-butoxide, I get a different ratio over here, slightly. Not that different, 79.3%. I'm still getting the more substituted double bond. I get 20.7% over here. So I get a little bit more in terms of that primary group. And in terms of the trans to cis ratio, what I get is I get, I think basically all trans, zero cis. When I do it with potassium tert-butoxide. So the question is, what's the difference between these two materials and what's going on? When I look at the two bases, let's say sodium methoxide, sometimes written this way, sometimes written NaOCH3. This one is sodium methoxide. And sodium methoxide really is just the sodium cation with a methoxide OCH3 anion. The other one, potassium O tertiary butoxide, this is potassium tertiary butoxide. I shouldn't say just butoxide, potassium tert butoxide. This one is the potassium cation. And here what I've got is a tertiary butyl group. Usually when I draw it, it makes it look pretty small. But now in comparison, when I put all the methyl groups that are on that, these two bases have very different sterics associated with them. This one is what is called a sterically bulky base. It has a lot of sterics around it. And the way that we refer to this is we refer to it as a bulky base. That bulky base implies that there's a lot of sterics that are around that base and that that base has a very difficult time getting into small areas. The other base, sodium methoxide, this is a small base. And it is more adept at getting into tighter spaces. what that does is that affects my product ratios in terms of how I'm looking at what protons are being pulled for this guy. So remember that what we said here is that when I'm looking at pulling a proton, the two different protons that I'm looking at pulling are the protons that are out in these two spaces. This is a bimolecular reaction where the base needs to pull the proton at the same type that the leaving group is leaving. That means that there are no hydride or alkyl shifts in these, and that I can only look at the protons that are adjacent to the leaving group. So when I look at this guy here, what I see is that the leaving group has two different types of protons that are adjacent to the leaving group. So I have these that are HB. These are on a secondary position. And I have the HAs, which are on a primary position. Which one of those protons gets pulled is somewhat a factor of the sterics around the proton, that there are more sterics around a secondary proton than there are around a primary proton. And so by using a small base has an easier time getting into these secondary centers where I can lead to the more substituted double bond. A bulky base has a much harder time doing that because it sees more sterics around the HB protons. The HA protons are easier to get to for the potassium tributoxide, and they lead to a less stable product, but they're the only protons that the potassium tributoxide can access to within reason. I mean, we're looking at this and we're saying this is a pretty modest change here in terms of going for the primary protons. We're only increasing a few percentages. But this can be, with more sterics, can be made to be more prominent. And so that's what we're going to see with these different bases as we start to go in with the different bases, is just that the sterics around this secondary center, and maybe I should have flipped my color scheme and made the secondary center really the red one. And in fact, I'm going to do that really quick because it just doesn't look right. I want to say that these guys have higher sterics trying to get there, as opposed to these that are HAs. There we go. And that this side has less sterics associated with it, and that it's easier to get to. That makes it a little bit easier. All right, so we're gonna go into these steric electronic effects more on Thursday. The stereo electronic effects more on Thursday. We'll talk more about the transition state and this need for this coplanarity of the leaving group and the proton, and how that actually plays into different sorts of substrates. So far, most of the reactions that we've been doing have all been linear reactions. I think I've thrown a couple at you that were ring systems, but really not many, only one that's here that's a ring system. But ring systems in particular for these E2 eliminations have some interesting ramifications, because in an E2 reaction on a ring system, we have to be concerned with how can we get anti-periplanar in order to be able to pull that proton. And what does that look like in a ring system? What protons are anti-periplanar, particularly in six-membered ring systems? And so that's where we're going to go next, is taking a look at these six-membered ring systems. In addition to that, we're going to come back together and we're going to take a bigger, broader view of SN1, SN2, E1, E2, and all of the factors that affect those reactions overall, and start to run through how to predict those reactions, which direction a reaction is going to go. Is it going to go E1? Is it going to go E2? Is it going to go SN1? Is it going to go SN2? And then to actually figure out what the product ratios are going to be. So we have a lot more to do coming up in this chapter, and another day at least, if not two, in terms of going through and looking at all of these reactions and how they all work together. All right, so I'm going to cut it there, and I'll get this up and posted, and I'll see you guys in lab tomorrow, and I'll see you back online on Thursday. All right, take care, everyone.